So we're here today with Sam, Sam A.
Yep.
Who was just recently 50 years gamble free. It was fantastic to have a meeting in Sydney. Sam, welcome today.
Thank you.
We're just going to ask you some questions here around your life in Gamblers Anonymous and the influence it had on your life.
Okay.
You grew up in Sydney, Sam. What was it like growing up in those days?
Well, I was born in 1924 in a slab hut in Bringelly Road, Kingswood, near Penrith. And this was on my grandfather's property, and my father's job was procuring horses for the English Army in India. And his job was to ride around the country selecting horses, bringing them home. He would train them a bit, groom them, and then the agent would come around and he'd sell them. Then in 1926 we moved to Windsor Road, Box Hill, where we grew up on a small farm, and it was I had four siblings. It was quite a happy life. It was very basic. Our home had no electricity, no running water. The water came from a well. We had to dispose of all our night soil for seven people on the property. And the principal method of transport was walking or by horse, horseback or on the sulky. And at 18, I was called up by the Army and then 6 months later transferred to the Air Force and was fortunate enough to become a pilot, which had been a boyhood dream. I served for about until 1946 in the services, and an unusual thing compared to my subsequent gambling was that in the services, fellas around me were gambling all around. I never took part. I thought, these are a bit stupid, you know, losing their money. In 1946, on discharge, I attended a race meeting at Rose Hill with my brother-in-law, and looking back, that was the beginning of 19 years of compulsive gambling. Mm.
Sam, would that be the first inkling you might have had a problem, or was it really about... What was it like?
Well, after about 6 months, yes, it was a problem, because I started telling lies about where I was getting money. I cashed in insurance policies. I was doing things that, you know, previously I thought I was a good character. I was married by this time. So after about 6 months, I was certain there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear about Gamblers Anonymous, and how old were you at the time?
Well, when I first started gambling, I was 21 years of age. That was 1946, not quite 21 years of age. And I gambled continuously then, getting worse for 19 years. After a couple of years, I knew this was entirely wrong, wanted to stop, so I went to my local GP, who more or less patted me on the head and said, just give it up, which of course didn't have any effect. Eventually, several years later, I went to Lifeline and there told the person there the whole situation, because I was very deeply in debt. They arranged for my house to be remortgaged, and I undertook to give up gambling. That lasted about 6 weeks, and then I was into it again. At that time, they referred me to Gamblers Anonymous, but I never ever went. I think that was about, 5 or 6 years before I actually went to GA. Mm. Then in 1965, I was estranged from my family and living in a single dingy room in a boarding house. And I'd met Helen, who was a very good close friend. And I forget the exact date, but it was about a week before I went to GA. I was really at my rock bottom. I was medically very ill. I had a very high blood pressure. I was shaking. I had one set of clothes. I had no money. I had money right, left and centre. And I was completely exhausted. And I think that was my rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And so I rang Helen up and said, I'd like to meet you. And I then confessed the whole situation. And I thought she'd just walk away and say, that's the end. Because I didn't think I was a very good prospect at age about 41 or 2 at that stage. Anyway, I mentioned Gamblers Anonymous, and she said, when's the meeting? And I said, next Saturday. She said, we'll be there. And so on that Saturday, we went to our first GA meeting.
And Sam, were you working at the time? Where were you working? And was that was this gambling affecting your work?
It was, but I was fortunate. I had a job as an administrator, was a clerk before the war in the education, state education department. And after the war, I came back to that, and I progressed to quite a senior position. As a matter of fact, I was private secretary to the Minister for Education when the end of my gambling. And because of my gambling, and I applied for bankruptcy, inadvisedly, I was sacked from the public service at age 42 and thrown out of work. So, yes, it must have been affected, but I was like a Jekyll and Dr. Hyde. I did my work pretty well, and I think that was a bit of a saviour from, you know, the worry of gambling.
Mm.
But, yes, it did affect. But I had a very good job. No need. So I lost all my super and the job I had for, you know, 20-odd, 30-odd years.
Mm. And you mentioned your first meeting at Gamblers Anonymous. Just describe for us that first meeting, the meeting room, the people that you met.
Well, I'll never forget it. It was a very hot February day, and Helen and I caught a tram along Cleveland Street, one of those Sydney trams that was rattling along, and I can tell you I felt very depressed. I thought there was no hope, you know, that this was the end. And when we alighted at High Holborn Street, my spirits didn't get any higher. There was a dilapidated fence, you know, a very old building, and I thought, God, what am I getting myself into? Then I walked into this small room where about four people were sitting, and a big fellow got up with a beaming smile, put his hand out and said, "I'm Phil, welcome to Gamblers Anonymous." And that was, that. When I look back, that was the beginning of the positive part of my life. There were four people there. I think there was Phil, there was Dave, South African Dave and his wife, and Daphne. And I just sat there mute for that meeting and several other, and Daphne and Phil and Dave spoke. And I remember afterwards Daphne's wife and Helen and I went and had a drink. Drinking wasn't a problem to me. And as we travelled home, Helen and I, we looked at each other and said, there might be some hope here.
And that's the question I was going to ask you. What did that first meeting, what impression did it leave with you?
It was marvellous because I thought I was the only one in the world that was, you know, gambling compulsively and neglecting my family and my children and become a liar and a cheat and, you know, pretty low. And here there were two other people, and particularly Phil, who'd been doing just as bad, if not worse, things, and yet he had been recovered for some years. So that gave me hope.
Mm. Describe how coming to the meetings in the ensuing months, or weeks and months, how that changed your work and your home life. Is there any?
Well, a few bad things happened to me after. By the way, there was only one meeting in Australia. One meeting in Australia, and that was the Sydney meeting. So it was very hard in between meetings because, as you know, we all get temptations to return. Luckily, I had Helen to speak to, and on occasions, I was that desperate, I went to AA meetings and just applied in my own mind gambling when they said alcohol. Look, I was suffered deeply from remorse, and I'm talking deep remorse of what I'd done to my family and children. And that lasted for two or three years. As I said, I had very high blood pressure. My conscience was shot to pieces. I had no conscience in myself. But I resolved in my own mind that if I didn't gamble, from what I'd heard from Phil, those things would get better. Now, after I stopped gambling, when the next 2 years I was divorced, as I said, I lost my job. I was out of work for a few days. Then I got some, I remember, I got a job at Sydney Hospital as a rouseabout. I then got a job with the, with some voluntary organisation as in the acting accountant. It was the Royal Blind Society, that's right. And I shouldn't have taken it, probably dealing with money. But anyhow, one funny thing about that, someone left a Rolls Royce from Double Bay bequeathed it to the Royal Blind. So I didn't know how to bring the books. But luckily I had a mate who was an accountant, so I was able to do that. And then I worked for Standard Telephones and Cables. You know, this is just as an ordinary clerk. And finally I got discharged from bankruptcy and I got back into the public service. But meanwhile, my first family did suffer. I mean, those three boys, you know, they didn't have the... for all that, the growing up, their father was away, there was a lack of money in the house. My wife had to go out and work. But fortunately, after a couple of years, the two younger boys had come to terms. The two older boys come to terms with it pretty well. The young fellow, we're still on fair friends, but I think it affected him worst of all.
You mentioned there Phil, and he's affectionately known as Founder Phil. What was your first impressions of Phil? Is there any stories around Phil?
Well, Phil, as you can imagine, in those first early years, the members of GA, because it was more like family. I mean, I'd lost my family to a degree at that stage. And so Phil and I, you know, we talked a lot, we met, and we went to football together. He supported South, I supported Parramatta, and then Harry came along, he supported East. So it was we started having like picnics, annual picnics. At one stage, we even went to a dinner dance at the Sydney University in one of their halls, where the, you know, there was mirrors on the walls, and it was rather strange to see about 42 people all dressed up. We had a nice German band, and all scrubbed up, sitting with their, you know, seats on, and it was really marvellous. But Phil and I became firm friends over the years. He moved around a bit. Phil, you remember, he used to live in a unit at Redfern when we had our first conference down at in New South Wales. I was lucky enough to have a transfer that conveyed Phil there and got him in the room. And look, we kept together for the whole of his life. He was a big influence on me. Big influence.
The late Harry P. He came to the meeting later on. Did you have a lot to do with Harry?
I became Harry's sponsor in a way. I recall him coming in. We were meeting at St Philip's Church in Sydney, and Harry came in, and he probably told you the story himself, but I remember that first night he had on, as most of us, I think he had one suit, and he tore the behind out of it on this meeting place. But, yeah, Harry and I, and one particular thing I remember, I said to Harry after we'd a few months, we resolved to each other, if we're going to have a bet, we would ring each other and say, look, we're going to have a bet. Now, Harry rang me one time. By the way, I was luckily unable to get him a job, but the forerunner of Harvey Norman, they started up as a small discount store. So Harry had a job there, and one day I was working at in Mark Foy's building, and he rang me up and said, Sam, I desperately feel like a bet. I said, where are you? He said, I'm at work. I said, just hold on, I've got to attend to a customer. And I jumped in a tram and went down and found him still hanging off the phone. And we went and had a cup of coffee. And then later on, I was at Harry's wedding when he married Anne. And he named his son Sam after me, as you probably know. That was an honour. And so there were lots of, you know, we used to go to football matches together and visit each other.
Without mobile phones in those days, how did you talk to each other? How did you guys connect?
It was extremely difficult. I mean, as you can imagine, I had to use public phones because I was not living in any permanent place in those first years. You had to use a public phone. And it was terrifically hard. It really was. And even when we got publicity, you see, it was difficult to get enough people, if you got a good response, as we did when Graham Gambry, a feature writer, wrote a big article in the Sun Herald about 1966 to 68, it was difficult to get people, suitable people, to answer all the inquiries we got. But we did our best, you know.
Yeah.
And even correspondence to get literature, we had to write, handwrite, because I had no type of handwrite, to America. And as you probably know, you've probably seen that book, I think, when one of the, was it Bill B, or one of them came out from America, 14 months later, he produced my request for a blue book. And in it was written, "We come across your request for a blue book, and although it's only 14 minutes later, I must emphasise the efficiency of the GA office in Los Angeles is something like
a little lacking. A little lacking.
Ray, isn't it?
Pippa?
Ray.
Okay. Ray.
Did members in those days tend to celebrate their 30 days, 1 year, 5 year anniversaries? Did you do that at all?
We did, but we didn't have any pens or anything like that. But, you know, they were highlighted at the meeting, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sam, you went to Chicago, I think, 1978?
Yes.
To attend a Board of Trustees meeting. What effect did that trip have on you?
Well, I was fortunate enough to go with Harry and two members of Gammon on, his wife Anne and Mary Rose. And it was really a big meeting. There must have been a couple of hundred people, Americans, Canadians, English, and Harry and I. And it was more than the trustees meeting, because I think it was an anniversary, 20th year, something like that. And I was absolutely inspired by that meeting, by the workshops. I went to a couple of meetings in America, and I was lucky to go to Canada with one of the members, and they took me to a couple of meetings. And so, but at the meeting, I was so inspired that I resolved that when I got back to Australia, I'd do all in my power to try and set up a regional service office. Mm.
Which leads me to the next question. The regional service office, or we call it RSO, started in Sydney in 1978? And was that a good thing? And why?
Well, I think it was established finally in 1978. There was a lot of work, not only myself. I mean, we had Dave and Harry and Phil and others, worked up. It sounds simple these days, but to acquire premises, to acquire reasonable rent and get equipment, and then to try and equip it at least half a day a week with some operator. And generally, first of all, it was members of Gammon came in to refer them to meetings and so on. And it was also not easy to get all the groups to agree, but finally we did. We had a delegate. The management committee was a delegate from each of the groups, and I think when I left it was working pretty well. Mm. But I think it was a good thing, because we provided a starter kit. If a new group wanted to start up, the RSA would provide a starter kit. They would provide a member to go along to the meeting and assist as much as possible, not only the first meeting, but several meetings later. For example, one night, four of us went to Wagga. I remember that trip well, because we got down there about 8 o'clock, and there was about three or four people there. And on the way back at Yass, a stone shattered the windscreen of whoever was driving. Was a borrowed car. And to make matters worse, when they knocked the windscreen out, they left the registration piece there, and we all had to dob in for the registration the next day. So I think it was a very good... And also, it acted as a telephone referral for people ringing up. The other thing that happened there, Anne P., Harry's wife, as a member of GAMNOS, she was very active. At that stage, the medical profession, health, had no knowledge of the problem of compulsive gambling. They recognised alcohol as a problem, and so as an education issue, we used to get in a group of health people, nurses, etc., and there'd be about an hour workshop with Anne and members of GA. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it served a good purpose, I think.
No doubt that would have actually helped in terms of people finding out more about Gamblers Anonymous.
Exactly.
Did it, Sam?
Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Mm. So, and they say service work is one of the cornerstones to recovery. And, the service work you did, like the RSO setting up and helping with that, how did it benefit you? And can you describe how it did benefit you in the long term?
Well, in my case, I was so full of remorse and regretful for the terrible things I'd done, to me, I'd done in that 19 years of gambling. The only way I saw of recovering was to immerse myself in GA. For example, if you've got cancer, you go and have chemotherapy. In my case, for the first 14 years, I was really active in GA in some way or another, almost on a daily basis, either talking to people, going to meetings or correspondence and so on, and that helped me. That helped me. I felt I was giving something back for the wrongs I've done, but in the meantime, it was helping me recover.
You recently reached your 50-year milestone, gamble-free. What's the journey been like, Sam?
Once I got over my remorse for the first two or three years, it's been a marvellous life. I've been very lucky, I think. As I said, I was divorced. I married Helen. We've got a daughter. My first wife is still alive. We talk to each other. We're quite good friends. Regretfully, my eldest son tragically died in 2007 in an accident, which was hit us hard because he and I had become, you know, very, very close. I was unable to do some more study. I was able to get a very good job. I ended up eventually as Chief Executive Officer of the Parramatta Education Office, about 70 people. More than that, I was able to get back into voluntary work, which I was doing before I started gambling. So, you know, everywhere I worked, I was secretary of the golf club, arranged annual balls. When I retired, I was in Neighbourhood Watch and Safety House, and that satisfaction, but the satisfaction of looking myself in the mirror, you know, after those two or three years and wasn't too, you know, saddened by what I saw. So it's been a really rich life. I wouldn't suggest anyone go through it, but I think going through that eventually made me a better person, albeit with still quite a lot of faults.
Mm. Look, we know health and illness will slow us all down. How are you? Your own health and illness will slow us all down. How are you coping with these things in your life?
Well, I think you've got to go back to the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change. Mm. Now, at 91, my health isn't the best. I've been in hospital 27 times and had 25 operations, but each time I've had faith in the doctors and I've had a lot of help in the home here with Helen. But look, I'm coping. It's pretty painful getting old, but I'm coping, and I think the GA experience has helped me to cope with life, even in my work. You know, if something's a problem, sort it out. Don't let it fester.
Mm. Today, what advice would you give any person, man or woman, walking into the rooms of Gamblers Anonymous for the first time, Sam?
Well, I'd say to them, have an open mind, listen to the people who've experienced some recovery, try and get a sponsor if you can, but don't give up. I mean, probably most people who've come in have been involved in gambling for a long time, and any recovery is not going to be any magic. It's going to take time. But the GA program does work, and I think if they listen to the people who come through it and acknowledge that and keep coming, that's the important thing.
Do you have any regrets?
None whatsoever. Except those years when I was gambling. I've got no regrets about GA, but I've got regrets that I treated my first wife and family as I did.
Okay. Sam, have you got any questions of us, or have you got any questions of the fellowship in general?
Not really. Mm. Well, the one thing I have been interested in, I suppose I could have done more, was I've been a bit disappointed that the idea of a regional RSO hasn't as far as I know, gone Australia-wide. I was hoping that it would go into other states. And the other thing, I haven't seen any publicity much in the last 3 or 4 years about GA. I just hope that the younger people coming on, you know, keep it going, because it saved my life. It really saved my life, because I was on the verge of going. And it saved, and I've seen from people I've been associated with in GA, how it can alter their life. That's been one of the rewarding things, is seeing a few people come into GA that I've been closely associated with, and they've recovered to become good people, good citizens.
Oh, fantastic.
Sam, do you want to give us a couple of the stories from the old days, you know, the early days where you were in there, some of the funny stories of...
Well, one was at Chicago. You've probably heard this story before, but there was about 20 contingent from there, and one was a medical doctor called Dr. Jack. Now, the story was told that Dr. Jack, he had the job of monitoring a lot of nursing homes with a lot of elderly people, and of course a lot of people passed away. And so at the height of his gambling career, Dr. Jack, he got the nursing homes to let him know as soon as a corpse was available, and he would hock it around to 2 or 3 funeral parlours to and give it to the highest bidder, in other words, a spotless fee. The other one, I forget his name, but we were meeting at Nithdale Clinic in Sydney, and he was a taxi driver, a lovely bloke, and he told the story of this day. He lived in Parramatta, and he finished his shift, and he was going to Parramatta, and he picked up a very attractive young lady because she was going near Rose Hill. And it so happened that Rose Hill races were on that day, and he had a tip for a certainty in the first. So he said he got very friendly with this girl, and when they arrived at her home, not far from the race course, he said, oh, whatever his name was, Jack, let's say, Jack, would you like to come in for a coffee? He said, and it was very tempting, but he said, I knew about this certain the first, he said, and I had to say no.
Very good. Look, thanks, Sam. It's been an honour and a pleasure to spend some time with you today. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Oh, it's a bit rambly, isn't it? Yeah.